The argument is that in the United States, the average American's mean discussion network from 1985 until 2004 has declined by about one-third, decreasing from a 2.94 to 2.08, a loss of about one social tie, which doesn't seem like a lot on the whole, but when you're talking about strong tie networks, which in general average from, you know, six to two dozen, and discussion networks that in general are only a few people, losing a full third of that network is fairly significant. The modal number dropped from 3 to 0, which suggests that most people, when they're answering this question, in 1985, most people gave three names. In 2004, most people had no one with whom they discussed important matters. This seems like a pretty important issue. And even more importantly, the majority of those ties that were lost over the last 20, 25 years or so were people who came from neighborhood and voluntary associations, meaning that a certain type of social tie has been lost or argued to be lost over the last 25 years ago, and that is relationships with neighbors and people in voluntary associations that tend to be more diverse. These are non-kin. If kin are the people, family members, who are the most socially similar to you in many different ways, as we'll see in a second in our discussion of homophily, then the loss of those social ties that are most different from you would seem to be important for access to diverse information and resources, even if they are strong and not weak ties. Before we discuss homophily, are there any questions at this point? Or everybody doing okay? I noticed that there was a great movement in the audience.
Yeah, we have questions.
We
would you come over here? 师傅，我们说问问题的话，要不要站到那儿来问？他现在如果要中间问一下问题，咱们现在情况是怎么回事？让他在这儿还是在这儿？哦，我是要问问题的，还是要这边来问？ So we have some questions for you.
Great.
Yeah, hello, Kisa. I have a question about the modal number drops from 3 to 0. I don't know what the modal number mean. Could you please explain?
Oh, more? The modal number. Okay, so the modal number is it's a measure of an average. It's like mean, for example. So the mean tends to be when you're what's the easiest way to compare this? So when you're doing some sort of statistical technique and you're looking for the average, the mode measure is one measure of an average. The mode is the most common answer. So if 10 people answer a survey and 6 of them say 0 and 4 of them say 1, the modal response is 0 because most people answered 0. So in the general social survey in 2004, when people were asked the question, with whom do you discuss important matters, most people said 0. No one.
Yeah, in other words, that's the most popular choice of the answers. In Chinese,
exactly.
It's zhongshu. If you know that, there are three ways to measure the central tendency: the mean, the median, and then the mode. No, if the distribution is normal, then all the three lie on the same point. Otherwise, it appears to be that. This is not a normal distribution. Definitely, it's a very skewed. If you have the largest category appears on 0, then that's a right skewed distribution.
Right, and interestingly, I mean, that distribution, the finding that most people answered 0, is incredibly controversial in American sociology right now. Sometime in the next few days, the latest issue of the journal American Sociological Review, which is a journal of the American Sociology Association, will publish two papers, one by McPherson, Smith-Levin, and Bashirs, and the second by Claude Fisher. And Claude Fisher is very convinced that there's something strange going on with the general social survey data. He argues that there was some massive technical error or some effect related to the context of where the question was placed in the survey that influenced people's answers in a way that doesn't truly represent the state of American society. McPherson, Smith-Levin, and Bashirs argue that No, in fact, they are correct that there was no technical error. And even if there was an over-reporting of that zero number, that it wouldn't change the mean of the number of people with whom people discuss important matters in the United States. And we have, Loie and I have some findings, along with another colleague of ours, Jenny Herr, that will be released sometime in September as a result of a Pew Internet and Everyday Life project, which is a survey that was done on a national sample of Americans, where we replicated that question from the General Social Survey. And one of our findings was that, in fact, a much smaller percentage of the population said they have no one with whom they discuss important matters. The percentage of people that we found reporting that they have no one that they discuss important matters with was about 12%, which is much closer to the finding in 1985 than the finding in 2004. So we're kind of in on the side of something went wrong with the U.S. General Social Survey in 2004 that can't be explained. And we suspect that when they replicate that question again in, I think, 2 years, they're going to find just an anomaly, some kind of strange blip that overreported social isolation in America. We'd like to think that Americans aren't that socially isolated. But at the same time, you'll see some of these findings tomorrow. We did find that even though fewer people than in the General Social Survey reported that they have no one that they discuss important matters with, that it did not, as McPherson, Smith-Levin, and Bashir suggest, change the mean all that much. That the size of people's discussion networks in the United States has declined over the last 25 years or so by about one person, which is fairly significant.
One more question.
I have one more question.
Can you please say your name so I know who you are?
All right. My name is Lou, L-U.
Hi, Lou.
So very my question then. Is that did the General Social Survey ask about the offline discussion or the online discussion or include both of them?
A very keen question. very good question. So this is a very relevant for our discussion today about new media. So the wording of this question, with whom do you discuss mm-hmm. important matters? There's a great deal of literature out there about what important matters might mean. And we know that when we're asking people, what do you discuss important matters? We ask them, well, what were you thinking about? They give you all sorts of answers. Everything from cloning headless frogs to politics. And there's some interesting unsystematic variation by gender about what important matters are. So we know that women, for example, when they were asked what's an important matter, they tend to say, oh, it's something to do with relationships and emotion. And men seem to say, well, no, it has to do with politics. So these are very different interpretations of what important matters is. We have to assume that there's probably a similar disconnect in interpretation about what discuss means, right? Particularly in the age of the internet. Is discuss only something that takes place in person, or is it also something that can take place over the mobile phone or online? Claude Fisher, for example, has written extensively about how the use of the telephone might change discuss. So we were very aware of this when we went back into the field to try and answer this question. And I'll show you some findings tomorrow that highlight this in more detail. But essentially, the answer is the General Social Survey didn't specify what they meant by discuss. Mm-hmm. But the assumption is they really meant in-person, face-to-face contacts. What we're doing wouldn't qualify as discuss. But when people are asked that question cognitively, it turns out that they really don't differentiate. Mm-hmm. The discuss is just what you do in interpersonal interaction, regardless of the type of communication. And I'll show you how we came to that conclusion tomorrow.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
If we don't have more questions, we may just move on and keep talking.
Great.
Would you please continue your lecture and then we will have more questions or you can interrupt you. Is that okay?
Sounds great. Okay. So homophily. Homophily is the argument that contact occurs at a higher rate among similar than dissimilar people, or the similarity breeds connection. Now, these are two different things that relate to homophily. So one is that people like to interact with people who are like themselves, as this comic suggests, which I'm not sure if the humor translates well, but birds of a feather flock together. So similar birds travel together because they're similar, right? The other problem is that similar birds also tend to go to the same marsh, right? So similar birds hang out in similar places as well. So the stronger the tie, the higher the homophily. So that's the one thing we know for sure. So homophily can limit the information people receive and in turn influence attitude formation. So in what ways do networks tend to be homophilous? Well, they tend to be homophilous in almost every possible way. Race, ethnicity, education, intelligence, religion, attitudes, height, hair color, eye color, nose length, you name it. Homophily occurs across almost every conceivable social characteristic. People hang out with people like themselves and form relationships in that way. So, for example, you all hang out with a lot of other really smart people. Not necessarily because you like all those really other smart people, because we put you all in one room together for the last 2 weeks, right? So homophily is a force that acts in two ways. It is people who like to hang out with people who are like themselves and just the general tendency for people who are similar to conglomerate in similar places. Okay? So the similar authors from the last study, McPherson again, Smith-Levin and Cook this time, have an article called Birds of a Feather that outlines this argument very well. And in the United States, the issue of homophily is almost always an issue that deals with race and race relations, sometimes gender. Although, again, this issue applies across almost all social characteristics. So the big question tends to be, why do people have fewer cross-race ties than we would expect based on the distribution of the American population? So there's baseline homophily, and then there's inbreeding homophily. So baseline homophily is the opportunity for interaction based on the number of similar people in the population. So the expectation here is in a racially representative setting. So in a setting where the people who are present represent the distribution of the entire population, being in a racially small category would make cross-race friendships more likely. Simply because if you're a member of a minority, you have access to a bigger population than the majority, and as a result, based on kind of a random distribution, you would expect that the people in the minority group to have more cross-race ties. However, an empirical evidence supports this to some extent in that in the United States, racial and ethnic minorities in workplaces tend to have more diverse advice and support networks. However, there's a counterforce, and that counterforce is this inbreeding homophily. And that is that in-group variation from this kind of baseline random affiliation. So the expectation here is that people are attracted to similar others, and similar people are attracted to similar places. So the evidence of this is a very, shocking lack of diversity in most people's social networks. Even though there's this random distribution where we would expect minority groups, for example, to have more diverse networks than majority group on average, what we find is that's not the case. That while there is, a general trend in that direction, there's also a stunning lack of diversity in that because people like to hang out with people who are similar to themselves, and because we have social forces that both ghettoize people and the tendency for people to want to hang out in similar places that those who are like themselves, there is this tendency towards inbreeding homophily. Network size. So how big are people's social networks and why do we care? Is there a maximum size? And how do we measure it? Again, I think this was one of the questions that was sent to me that we're hoping to answer over the next couple of days. Is there a maximum network size? So this is by far probably one of the most controversial and widely cited network papers that exists. So this is a paper that was done by two folks named Hill and Dunbar. They are they're anthropologists out of the United Kingdom. Their hypothesis is that the size of the human neocortex, the size of this part here, right, the brain, is predictive of the maximum network size for humans. So they're anthropologists, and they have a whole series of observations of primate grooming cliques. Do we know what primate grooming cliques are? Cliques? I see some head shaking. Okay, primate grooming cliques. This is apes, right? Apes being observed in the wild, in social groups, in cliques. What do apes do in the wild, in social groups, in cliques? They pick nits off of each other, lice, and they eat them. That is a primate grooming clique, okay? So observations of apes in the wild and the size of their nit-picking groups.
Sorry,
wasn't as much shock as I was expecting.
They all knew that in Chinese, so I just tried to...
Oh, good. Good.
I have to remind everyone, it's uncivilized. Don't do it anymore.
So they argue that there are cognitive constraints on the number of individuals that can be maintained at a given intensity of a relationship. So they suggest that by looking at these primate nitpicking groups, that you can extrapolate from that to humans and maximum network size. So from that extrapolation, based on the size of nitpicking groups and the human neocortex, they come to a number of 150. So they suggest that 150 persons, the so-called Dunbar number, is the maximum size of human social networks. And then they go out and they try to empirically test this by looking at the number of people you can contact through Christmas cards each year as a measure of network size. And this was conducted in the United Kingdom with 43 families, and they found that each person sent 11 to 149 cards and contacted 1 to 9 people each for a total of just under 3,000 cards. And it turned out, on average, that was 154 ties, almost exactly the Dunbar number. Very exciting for them. But if my undergraduates ever did this study, I'd be extremely upset. I mean, this is horrible social science in my mind. I don't see how Christmas cards are a good measure of social ties. I mean, we can see all sorts of biases here, right? I mean, even the United Kingdom is a fairly diverse culture. We can assume that not everybody celebrates Christmas. We can assume that there's some variation in the tendency to send Christmas cards. It's very unsystematic. We don't really know what this number of 150 means. But for the longest time, if you went to Wikipedia and you searched on social networks, what you would get was a one paragraph that said, a social network is 150 people. It's the Dunbar number. Thankfully, Barry Wellman came along and wrote a very long entry on what is social networks, not to out his Wikipedia identity. But nonetheless, 150 does not seem like a reasonable measure of the maximum network size. That said, within the organizational literature, this number of 150 does pop up a lot. There does seem to be some evidence that there is a certain level of intimacy that 150 is important in some way in terms of maintaining a network before it starts to fracture at some level of intimacy. I don't know what that level of intimacy is. I don't know why, but the data seems a little suspect. Nonetheless, other people have attempted to measure network size. There are a series of approaches that you could utilize to try and measure social network size. We have to ask, are you interested in whole networks or personal networks? You can ask people to write down all the people they know. This turns out to be an absolutely atrocious measure, almost as bad as counting Christmas cards. If I give you a pen and paper and ask you to write down every person you know, it would probably not be a very long list. We would get a list of people who you've had some fairly recent contact with, or maybe who are most important in your life, but probably not the full size of your social network. You can ask people to maintain a diary. They can carry around a pen and a paper and record everybody that they interact with over a certain period of time. This also tends to be a pretty poor measure of total network size, but a good measure of active social networks. So those people who you interact with kind of on a day-to-day basis.